Welcome back to the London Futurist podcast. As artificial intelligence models become increasingly powerful, they both raise and might help to answer some very important questions about one of the most intriguing, fascinating aspects of our lives, namely consciousness. It is possible that in the coming years or decades, we will create conscious machines. If we do so without realizing it, we might end up enslaving them, torturing them, and killing them over and over again. This is known as mind crime, and we must avoid it. It's also possible that very powerful AI systems will enable us to understand what our consciousness is, how it arises, and even how to manage it, if we want to do that. Our guest today is the ideal guide to help us explore the knotty issue of consciousness. Anil Seth is Professor of Cognitive and Computational Neuroscience at the University of Sussex. He's amongst the most cited scholars on the topics of neuroscience and cognitive science globally, and a regular contributor to newspapers and TV programs. His most recent book was published in 2021 and is called Being You, A New Science of Consciousness. Anil, thank you very much indeed for joining the London Futurist podcast.
Thank you, Callum. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Anil, many thanks for joining us.
Thanks, David.
Anil, in your book, you conclude that consciousness may well only occur in living creatures. You say it is life rather than information processing that breathes the fire into the equations. What made you conclude that?
That's the result of many years of thinking about this. I don't know this for sure. And there's both a push factor and a pull factor at work here. There's a very common assumption in both artificial intelligence and in neuroscience, though maybe a bit less, that consciousness is some kind of computation, some kind of information processing, so that if you programmed a computer in the right way, it would actually have experience. It would feel like something to be that computer or that piece of software running on it. And I just think this is a massive assumption. In philosophy, it's called computational functionalism, the idea that computation provides a sufficient basis for conscious mental states. And it's been a dominant assumption, partly because the metaphor of the brain as a computer has been a very useful metaphor, but it's ultimately just a metaphor. There are many differences between brains and computers. And I think intuitively, when you start looking more deeply at what kind of thing a brain is, the idea that it's a computer and therefore that things intimately associated with brains like consciousness are matters of computation just becomes less and less clear. In a brain, there's no clean separation between what you might call the mindware and the wetware, as there is between the hardware and the software in a computer. And there are many reasons to think that whatever brains do cannot be readily dissociated from what brains are. Even a single neuronal spike, neurons are brain cells, they fire in these little action potentials, is discrete spikes, which make us think of a kind of binary computer. That's one of the things that makes the metaphor appealing. But even single neuronal spikes, sometimes they have the function of stopping a neuron from dying. So they're intimately connected to this storm of metabolism that's always going on in every living cell, in every neuron. This is just one example of how it's really hard to separate what things are from what they do in the brain. So it may be that even if consciousness is a matter of computation, you still need something like a brain to do it. It's the kind of thing that only biological substrates, biological material is capable of supporting. And then on the other hand, without going too far into the weeds, that's like the push away. But I also think there's a pull towards. And the story I tell in the book is consciousness being explained as a kind of perceptual prediction. And for me, this goes down all the way into what we're made of. Even single cells persist over time. They maintain their integrity against dissipative forces like second law of thermodynamics and so on. And there's just this through line from, again, what brains do to what they are. And life is at the core of that. Life ultimately is this process where a system generates its own material substance. Cells continually regenerate their own possibility of existence in the future. This is why I think life is probably what breathes fire into the equations of consciousness.
Just to dig very quickly into one part there, you said that there's no hard distinction between mindware and wetware. Yet isn't it true that some groups of neurons can be reprogrammed? The plasticity of the brain, if people lose their sight, that part of the brain can be taken over and used for a different computational purpose?
Well, it's certainly true that the brain can change. This is something brains do very well. Every time a neuron fires, everything changes, which for me is actually another reason to push back against the metaphor of the brain as a computer. Computers wouldn't work very well if every time a bit flipped in something, then everything else changed. The hardware is relatively fixed and the software is what changes. Brains don't work like that. A neuron fires, connection strength change, chemicals wash around, and so on. So yes, there is change, and that change is what allows us to learn, and not only if we lose our sight or something like that, but just in everyday experience. Our brains are always changing, always adapting, and it's that pervasiveness of plasticity that makes brains, in this sense, I think, different from computers. So I don't think you can say that because brains change a lot, that they can be reprogrammed. That's, again, smuggling in this language of computation, where it might be useful metaphorically, but when our visual cortex learns to respond to sound when we lose our sight, I really don't think that the metaphor of that visual cortex being reprogrammed is particularly powerful. It's very high level.
If somebody was able to model what goes on in a brain, create a functional replication of it, which no AI does at the moment, they operate in different ways, but it wasn't alive, this model wasn't alive, would you accept that might be conscious if it reported it was conscious? Or would you say that by modeling the human brain, it had become alive?
This is an excellent question. Firstly, the fact that something says it's conscious, I don't think is a good reason to believe that it is, especially when it comes to AI. It might be a good reason if it was, let's say, a non-human primate or something where we've got so much more in common. But of course, it's pretty trivial, and we've already seen this with language models, and even before language models, simple chatbots, obviously capable of saying anything. It doesn't mean that that's true. Now, on the question of what we might describe as whole brain emulation, let's say we have a simulation in a computer of every little detail of a brain that we know to be conscious. Your brain, let's say, Callum, we simulate it in every last bit of detail.
Oh, yes, please.
Will we have generated the experience of being Callum in this machine? Now, the honest answer is I don't know, but I think there's good reason to be skeptical about that. Firstly, there's good reason to be skeptical that that's even possible. And this echoes what we were talking about a minute ago. It just might be that the kinds of functional organizations inside your brain that make you you just cannot be simulated in every level of detail on a computer. And there's reasons to think why this might be the case, that some things that brains do are just intimately tied to what they're made of. But let's set that aside and let's say, okay, now we can, in fact, emulate everything about your brain in a computer. Is that another artificially conscious Callum? This is where agnosticism definitely creeps in. Now, there are some things for which, if you simulate them, it remains just a simulation. Like if you simulate a weather system, however detailed your simulation is, it never actually gets wet or windy. For that, you need real air molecules, real water molecules. But other things, if you simulate them, it really counts as instantiating the thing itself, realizing the phenomenon. A computer that plays chess really does play chess. So this is the question. Is consciousness more like the weather, where a simulation will only ever be a simulation? Or is it something more like chess, where a simulation is actually an instantiation too? My suspicion is that a simulation of consciousness will just be a simulation, because I think there's good reason to think that consciousness is not a matter of computation. But that would put us into a difficult position, because it would seem as though you are. From the outside, it would be very hard to tell the difference. But on the inside, it might just remain a simulation. It's one of these philosophical thought experiments that might always remain in the realm of thought experiment, because it just might not be possible to create something that actually captures everything about you in a different medium. You can't build a computer out of pieces of plasticine. It just doesn't work that way. The physics of the world don't work that way.
Yeah. We've been talking about consciousness and life, which are, of course, are rather difficult subjects to pin down. We probably ought to try and define them a little bit. I think we can probably dispense with the definition of consciousness because we all kind of know what it is. It's the experience of being like something. That's not adequate, but it'll probably do for current purposes. Life is an interesting one because people rarely think about what they mean by the word life. What are you using life to mean? Simply an entity which seeks to sustain itself and reproduce? Or have you got a more technical definition than that in mind?
And consciousness, I think that definition is a good one. It goes back to Thomas Nagel and his definition for a conscious organism. It feels like something to be that organism. I also like to define it as what is lost when you go under really deep general anesthesia and what comes back when you come around again. Anyone who's had general anesthesia, that kind of hits the mark. Life, I think there's a good lesson to be learned from the definitions, the evolving definitions of life. Life is not one thing. There is no single thing that demarcates the living from the non-living. That insight was hard won. 150 years ago, 200 years ago, the philosophy of vitalism wasn't like this at all. It was proposing that there was a special source, an élan vital, a spark of life that differentiated the living from the non-living. There was a hard problem of life, much as people think there's a hard problem of consciousness now. And it was partly through recognizing that life is not one thing. It's a constellation of properties which can be present to different degrees. And there are gray areas that we actually made progress in understanding that life could be explained in terms of physics and chemistry. There's a sort of historical lesson here that recognizing that a concept is not necessarily just one single thing can help us demystify it. But then the specifics about life, if we think about what is it that makes life significant, the thing I come back to is not so much reproduction. That to me is how life has developed on our planet. But I can imagine forms of life that can be created in the lab that don't reproduce. We already have some things like this. For me, it's about the self-producing nature, the energy exchanges at the core of every living thing. People often focus on genes and say the DNA is the most important. That's the code of life. It might be the code, but the deep reality of life for me is more grounded in metabolism, in the way living systems take in energy for their environment and use that energy to create materials, to perform reactions, to regenerate their own components.
I think you've just described a car.
Well, no. It's a great contrast, though. Because the concept I was coming to comes from this Chilean biologist, Humberto Maturana, and his colleague Varela. They talk about this thing called autopoiesis. Autopoiesis derives from the Greek for self-production or self-creation. And the idea of an autopoietic system, like a cell, a living cell, it's a system that constitutes a sort of network of processes. And these processes can be things like catalytic reactions inside cells, metabolic chains of flux and so on. But they don't just transform inputs into outputs. They create their own conditions for existence. This whole network of reactions creates the very components necessary to sustain those reactions. And they also maintain a boundary between what the system is and what it is not, the cell boundary. So it's continually regenerating its own material basis and distinguishing itself from what it isn't. That's a kind of machine, but it's a very different kind of machine to a car, or let's say a factory, which, as we all know from owning cars, they don't just fix themselves. You've got to take them to the garage. They don't just regenerate their own brake pads. You have to go and replace them. And computers are on the side of cars, not on the side of cells. And that autopoietic basis for living systems, for me, that provides a reason for a continuity between what something is made of and what it does. Because to maintain this autopoietic integrity, there's a good argument to be made that then the system is engaging in a form of minimization of something called free energy and minimizing the statistical surprise of sensory states. And from there, I mean, this is cutting a very long story very short. From there, the whole machinery of perception, of perceptual inference, And I think everything that helps us understand how consciousness arises in humans, everything else follows.
Okay. Let's, if we can, put aside your skepticism about whether AI could be conscious. You don't exclude the possibility, but you've thought more about consciousness than most people. So a question which preoccupies me a lot at the moment is, if we imagine that we are on a track towards superintelligence, would it be better for humans if the first superintelligence was conscious?
Before answering that, I'm sorry to keep adding caveats, but I think there's a very important one here, which is the relationship between intelligence and consciousness. I mean, I think this is another thing that leads people to overestimate the likelihood of AI being conscious or consciousness being computational. We do tend to conflate these things. Academics do it, people in the media do it, people in tech do it, people in film do it. There's this idea out there that as systems become more intelligent, there will at some point be a threshold and then the lights come on and we have systems that are not only smart, but also conscious.
I'm actually really explicitly agreeing with you there. I know you're also skeptical about the possible arrival of superintelligence and anything like the foreseeable future, but let's say that is going to happen. I entirely agree with you. It may be conscious or it may not, and we just don't know. But I think there's an interesting question about whether we would prefer it to be conscious or not.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So we've recognized that these things are distinct and that you cannot assume that consciousness is going to come along for free as things get smarter. And the assumption that it does is based, I think, in our human exceptionalism and anthropocentrism and our tendency to associate these things. Now, by super intelligent, do you mean artificial general intelligence or something that is generally more intelligent than a human being?
Yes. I take AGI as simply to mean human level intelligence. It's a machine which is at least as good as us at every cognitive task. And then super intelligence is everything beyond that. I actually think AGI is an almost irrelevant concept in that it's just the boundary between us and machines, which are much smarter than us in every possible way. And I think that machines, if they do this, if they do achieve superintelligence, they'll blow through AGI or human level intelligence pretty fast. And at the time they hit AGI, they'll already be much better than us at many things. For instance, mental arithmetic, they're well beyond that already. But quite quickly, we'll be into the realm of superintelligence, whether machines are much smarter than us in every possible cognitive respect.
So I agree. I think AGI is not a really helpful threshold because AI has already passed it in some regards. And when it reaches the general intelligent competence of a human, it will already be superior in many, many other ways. I think it's arguable that we should aim anyway to be designing AI that is not trying to match or exceed human level intelligence, but rather complement human intelligence. That's something I keep coming back to, not trying to build these things in our own image in some weird godlike way, but how can we best compensate for the things that our human minds are not very good at, like reasoning over long time scales and so on. Anyway, that aside, is it a good idea for AI to be conscious? Well, I think no, but there's a trade-off here. The main reason for saying no is that as soon as something becomes conscious, and again, I think this is very unlikely, but of course I might be wrong. It may be that the computationalists are right in that consciousness is a function of computation. But however we happen upon synthetic consciousness, whether it's AI or something else, is that a good idea? Well, the main reason for saying no is, of course, the ethical and moral stance, which is that as soon as something is conscious, it deserves moral considerability. You mentioned this earlier, this kind of mind crime. We don't want to be in a situation where we've introduced at industrial scale the potential for aversive negative experiences, perhaps suffering of a form we might not even recognize because it would be so distinct from our own. That would be an ethical catastrophe. So consciousness is a serious business. We'd have to be very careful about how we treated conscious artifacts. We wouldn't be able to turn them off if we didn't agree with what they were doing. So that's the main reason for saying no. Having said that, there are things that AI currently is not very good at, which we seem to be good at in virtue of being conscious. If you look at the psychology, cognitive neuroscience of consciousness, which compares what we can do when we're conscious of something versus not, there are things like learning very rapidly from one or two data points. There are things like having insight into whether you're right or wrong. There are things like generalizing to novel situations, what in AI is often called sort of out of distribution generalization. These are things that AI systems so far are not great at. These are the things that we can do when we're conscious of the stimuli involved, of the things involved. So there's an argument to be made that understanding how consciousness happens in humans and how its function arises, that could be useful for AI. But then we're on a slippery slope. How do we know we're not therefore building conscious systems, which I don't think we should do? So there is an argument on both sides, but for me, we shouldn't try to do it because of the moral point.
This is where I really like your idea of dividing the concept of consciousness into separate angles. A bit like 100 years ago or so, we discovered that life wasn't just a single thing, and you shouldn't get bogged down in arguing whether or not a virus was alive or not. In terms of the attributes of consciousness, you've talked about one attribute which allows us humans to be better at generalizing from a small number of examples. There's also the angle of volition. You talk about the volitional self as one of the components. I worry personally that we're going to create AIs that have independent volition, and whether or not they've got the other attributes of consciousness will decide by themselves that they're going to do things contrary to our programming. So how do you go about untangling these different notions of consciousness? And how would we figure out, for example, what is the thing about human brains that allows us to do this out-of-distribution learning? Could we get that without having all the other stuff to do with consciousness as well? The stuff that would make AIs feel terrible pain and we would be inflicting mind crimes on them.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's exactly the way to go. How do we get there? Well, just as there's been huge amounts of resource going into AI to try and develop bigger, better AI systems, we need a similar thing to understand human consciousness. It is precisely by understanding the brain basis of different aspects of how consciousness happens to arise in humans that we'll have a principled basis for doing exactly what you say. Thinking, okay, we understand how and why this out of distribution generalization is done. Maybe it's something to do with the way consciousness is able to rapidly integrate different sources of information very flexibly. Maybe that's what underpins this generalization ability. And so we can just model that. And then we get that in AI without any of the other connotations. The thing you said about volition is also really, really key. In our lived experience, it's very hard to recognize that these things are contingent rather than necessary facts about consciousness, because volition is so present to us. Whenever I talk about consciousness, that's the aspect of consciousness people seem to feel most precious about, their supposed free will. But I think it's contingent. I don't think it's necessary. I think it's possible to imagine conscious systems without volition. There are certain instances of human beings with certain psychiatric or neurological illnesses who seem to have no experiences of volition at all. This condition is called akinetic mutism. So it may be possible to design AI systems to not have any agency or volition. Yoshua Bengio has talked about this, the idea of the ideal AI being some kind of oracle that's very, very wise, but it doesn't have its own interests. The larger frame for this is, of course, the problem of value alignment. How do we ensure that AI acts according to our values? And this is such a hard problem, partly because we don't even know what our own values are or should be. And then if a machine is smarter than us in some way, well, maybe it won't find reasons to ignore our own estimation of our own values and think that what's in our interest is something that we don't think is. So there's lots of thorny issues around here, but it strikes me that there's a design space. We might want AI that explicitly is designed to have no agency. On the other hand, and I know some people have talked about this too, that agency might be the solution to this value alignment problem, that if we endow artificial systems with some kind of agency that is guaranteed to be aligned with at least some core values, that's of course very, very tricky to do. That might be a way of ensuring that the competences in AI systems are used in a way or are manifest in a way that is good for us. this idea of being able to just separate how consciousness manifests in us from how it has to manifest. That's a good way to think about what we might want in artificial systems.
Yeah. And whether we want to have conscious AIs or not, I might come back to that in a second. It's surely a good idea for us to be working hard to understand our own consciousness better. And we should surely be working hard to figure out how we would detect consciousness in an AI in case it arises, because the prospect of causing massive amounts of mind crime by accident is really horrific. So we ought to be carefully working out how we would spot it if it does appear to arise. I'm quite persuaded by the argument that if a superintelligence does appear, it may not, but if it does, and it's not conscious, it will have no idea, really, what our consciousness means to us or means in general, and it won't be able to appreciate it. Whereas if a superintelligence is conscious, it will presumably, and I think it's a pretty decent assumption, have an appreciation for, a sympathy for, an empathy for consciousness in other entities, even if it regards their consciousness as being of a much lower scope in the way that we regard a dog's consciousness is of a lower scope than ours, and therefore may be more kindly disposed towards us. I think that's quite a decent argument. Do you have any sympathy with that?
I have a little bit of sympathy. I'm not sure how compelling it is on both of the points that you make. So one point was that if an AI is not conscious, then it wouldn't be able to understand in some relevant way the importance of being conscious as we are. That to me is not entirely clear. It could well be that AI is perfectly capable of understanding the moral, ethical, experiential importance of consciousness without being conscious. Why not? It brings up a possible distinction, again, between understanding and consciousness, which is something that we tend to put together because we think understanding sort of requires consciousness. But for example, with language models now, I think there's a really interesting question to ask about whether you can say that language models truly understand something but are not conscious at all, which would be a very novel kind of thing. And we haven't encountered that kind of thing before. It may be that language models still don't really understand anything. They just do what they do. And for a language model to understand, maybe it needs a body and some sensory motor interaction with the world, but it still wouldn't be conscious. So it's not clear to me that you need to be conscious to understand in some relevant way the importance of being conscious.
I suppose the definition of understanding is important there. There's a definition of understanding which means the ability to associate different concepts and work out how they relate and therefore make forecasts about or deductions about other things as a consequence of those relationships. And on the other hand, a definition of understanding which involves a conscious awareness, a conscious appreciation of the thing. And they're two different types. You could defend both definitions of understanding. Machines clearly have the first and they clearly don't have the last.
Whether they have the first or not, I think, is also arguable. And I think there's different degrees of that too. I think there's a sort of weak understanding which might be manifest in the ability to generalize to some extent. And there's a sort of stronger version of understanding, which is a bit more like grokking. The system has really got it in the sense that you can be confident it's going to generalize in the right way in a novel situation. Whether systems have that level of understanding is unclear. But yes, even a system that groks something might do it in an unconscious way. And that might be the interesting space in which AI systems end up.
But maybe consciousness is a different kind of thing in that you can really only understand it if you've experienced it. I mean, the same way that I've never been blind, but a blind person's understanding of what red is probably very different from my understanding of what red is. And who knows, my understanding of what red is might be very different from your understanding of what red is.
Well, that's right. In fact, one of our projects, just to bring it back down to the boring terrain of empirical work, one of the projects that I'm very excited about is measuring perceptual diversity. We've had this big project looking at, indeed, how different our experiences of even the same shared reality are. We tend to think they're more similar than they actually are because we use the same words and because our experiences have the character of revealing reality as it really is, rather than as a kind of construction, which is what I think is going on. But yeah, this is an old philosophical trope about the kind of knowledge that is given directly by experience. Mary the color scientist is the classic example of that. Mary, the color scientist, knows everything about color vision, has studied everything, done all the experiments, but has never seen anything red because she lives in a basement. There's no colored things at all. And then she goes outdoors and sees a red rose. And what happens? I think most people now say, well, of course, there's something new happening because the sum total of knowledge about red is not the same as the experience of red. For me, that's kind of uncontroversial and fairly obvious that being something is different from knowing about that thing.
And that's the sense in which I think superintelligence, which was conscious, would have a different appreciation of it than one that wasn't. David, you were going to ask a question.
I wanted to go on to the empirical questions again, in terms of what experiments should we be doing. You suggested, Anil, that modern types of computers won't be able to have some of the aspects of consciousness because of hardware features. So would you support the scientists who are trying to build computers out of biological content? They take bits of brain cells and mush them together and see whether they can do computations. Is that something that should be encouraged?
Yes, but within pretty clear regulatory frameworks. I think this is very interesting. I think there's a lot of interesting work going on in neuromorphic computing, computers that share more features with biology than the kinds of computers we have now. None of what I'm saying says that conscious AI is impossible. It's just that it might have to be much more similar to biological consciousness than we currently have. It's not just going to be by extrapolating GPT-4 to GPT-8. It's a bit tricky because how do you know where you've crossed the line between trying to understand the nature of consciousness, the basis of consciousness, and actually recreating it in a way that risks this moral catastrophe? There's no easy answer to that besides, you mentioned earlier, Callum, about having a test. We don't have a test. We do not have a test for whether something is conscious or not. And the kinds of tests that we do have are very different depending on the kinds of things we apply them to, because you know, our knowledge about them, our priors about them are all different. So proceed with caution is the right strategy here. Now, I've been involved in a couple of discussions about the ethics of organoid research in biomedicine. Organoids, brain organoids, are these clusters of brain cells derived from human stem cells. So they're basically human-like brain cells which self-organize into clusters which begin to wire up together and show coordinated electrical activity of some sort. Now, I'm much more worried about consciousness arising accidentally in things like this than I am in the next iteration of language models, because they're made out of the same stuff. So a whole level of uncertainty about whether the stuff matters, what we were talking about at the top, you know, that just goes away because they're made out of the same stuff. But they don't exercise our biases in the same way because they don't really do anything. They just sort of sit there in a Petri dish, you know, unless you wire them up to a robot. So we're more likely to make false negatives in our attribution of consciousness to future organoids, in the same way that we've been liable to make false positives about consciousness in language models because of their ability to grab on to our psychological, anthropomorphic, anthropocentric biases.
You say we don't have a test for consciousness, but maybe we have the beginnings of one. In your book, you suggest that the Turing test may be a better test for consciousness than for intelligence, which is something I've long thought. There's lots of ways of testing for intelligence, and you don't need the Turing test for it. If you had a machine which had conversations with, say, a couple of dozen bright humans over a period of a month. And at the end of that period, all the humans said, you know what, I cannot find any reason not to believe this thing is conscious. It reports it's conscious. It behaves exactly the same way that we all do, we humans do. And after all, the only reason I believe you're conscious is because you behave the same way that I do. I've got no direct access to your consciousness. If that happened, I think we'd be hard pushed to deny its consciousness. So maybe the Turing test beefed up, a strong version of the Turing test, is a test for consciousness. It's not the only one, because you could have conscious entities which couldn't speak, which had no language, and they would obviously not pass the Turing test. But it'd be a way of validating consciousness.
There's a couple of things I want to push back on immediately about that. So when you say that the only reason you believe that I'm conscious is because of what I say, how I behave, that's not true. implicitly, you know that I'm made of the same stuff as you. We're both human beings. There's a shared historical, evolutionary, biological background that licenses the attribution of consciousness to me, that is garnished by my ability to say things like I'm conscious. But I think it's that shared constitution that there's a big part of you believing.
But if you were in a vegetative state, I wouldn't think you were conscious.
No, and you might be wrong. That's why probably the most action about detecting consciousness has been in exactly these kinds of conditions where we know that these people have brain damage, but before the brain damage, they were definitely conscious. And we try to distinguish whether they are truly unconscious or just dissociated to the extent or impaired to the extent they cannot express their conscious experiences. That's an area where there has been real progress. We now have the ability to, in many cases, detect cases of covert consciousness. But we trust them because of the amount of other shared features that we have with brain-injured humans, because they were once non-brain-injured humans. By the way, some of these tests don't rely on language at all. They rely on passive observation of brain dynamics. But onto the issue of tests, I don't think I said that the Turing test was a good test for consciousness. In fact, I think I try to say that the assumption that it is again conflating intelligence with consciousness. And the Turing test, classically, from Turing, was a test of whether machines can think. That's arguably something more to do with intelligence than consciousness. You've actually got four kinds of tests. You've got forward tests and reverse tests, and you've got Turing tests and what, following Murray Shanahan, I've called Garland tests. That comes from the film Ex Machina, written by Alex Garland, which is a great film. It's now 10 years old. It's still a fantastic film that really gets at this idea of how would we know whether an artificial system is conscious or not. If anyone listening has not seen it, you really should go and see this film. And there's a piece of dialogue in Ex Machina where the inventor is talking to the stooge in the film and says, no, the real test is to show you that she's a machine and see if you feel that she is conscious. And this is great because this reveals the distinction between a forward and a reverse test. A forward test is what we want. A forward test is ideally what we want. It's a test of whether a system has the property in question. Does it actually have intelligence, or does it actually have consciousness? Those would be the forward Turing test and the forward Garland test. But what do we actually have? Well, the discourse around Turing tests is much more developed, and there's a recognition that Turing tests are really mainly reverse Turing tests, that they're a test of what it would take for humans to attribute intelligence to a system. Certainly when it comes to AI, that's where most of our tests fall as well. They're testing what it would take for us to attribute consciousness to a machine. Whereas what we really want is a forward test of whether consciousness is there. Now, we have some forward tests, but they're for things like humans in vegetative states. They're not for language models. So this idea of a test for consciousness, there's no single answer to it, but we have to be very careful to make sure we're not confusing the kinds of tests we're talking about. And your worst case is confusing a reverse Turing test for a forward Garland test. And we don't want to do that.
Yeah. Mustn't mix up your forwards and backwards and your Turings and your Garlands.
We've had so many fascinating topics. And I just want to very quickly ask if you think that electricity is going to be important in understanding consciousness. You briefly mentioned electrical activity with these organoids. Some of my friends say in 10 years' time, theories of consciousness will be much more about electrical fields than they are either about computation or about neurons. Do you have any sympathy with that prediction?
I do a bit, actually. If you look at the history of neuroscience, fields have been important, and we measure electric fields with EEG. There are electric fields throughout the brain and beyond the brain. There's a history also of some theories of consciousness phrased in field terms. The neuroscientists John J. McFadden and Susan Pocket have long talked about field theories of consciousness. These theories have not got the traction of some of the other prominent theories of consciousness. I don't quite know why that is. They're perhaps less specific about the predictions they make. But I do think that greater attention to field properties is likely to happen. It's not new. We already talk about alpha waves. We talk about oscillations in the brain. They already are things that are a little bit more field-like in the sense that they're global oscillations rather than single neuronal spikes. There are very interesting questions about causality here. Do fields actually constrain the behavior of individual neurons, or are they just epiphenomenal that neurons fire and we see fields and can measure them as a result? I think there's probably good reason to think that you do have these kinds of causal constraints at higher levels onto lower levels. And that might be a very important part of understanding how brains work. So yes, and they do also make them quite different from computers, at least the standard computer architectures that we have. Neuromorphic computers may start to make use of fields. When I was doing my PhD years and years and years ago, one of my colleagues was messing around, well, not messing around, he was researching in a very pioneering way these field programmable gate arrays, which are reprogrammable chips. And he was using genetic algorithms to evolve architectures on them and evolved architectures that worked even when there were no connections and they were working implicitly because the evolutionary algorithm had picked up on some field effects from the power supply. So it's not implausible that we can develop new forms of chip, new forms of neural architecture that also leverage these kinds of field properties.
Do you have any other tips as to how the field of consciousness study might be changing in 5-10 years' time?
It's a really interesting time in the neuroscience of consciousness. I try to be optimistic about it. One reason for optimism is that in the time I've been involved in it, it's gone from something that was a little bit on the fringe, a little bit maybe disreputable, to something that is not only fairly mainstream in neuroscience, but also is beginning to bring in researchers from adjacent disciplines who recognize the importance. It's not just this big armchair mystery. It's a mystery that matters, not only in AI, but as we've said, in medicine, but also in society, also in law, ethics, and animal welfare, and all these things. It's a field with enormous implications for basically everything that we struggle with in society. So there's a huge change in involvement, engagement with the field. And we've discovered a lot more. We know a lot more about the brain basis of consciousness in humans and in other animals than we used to. But at the same time, there's still these big philosophical struggles about, are we really on the right track? Are we getting anywhere, in fact, or are we just going round in circles? I don't think we are. What I like to see in the next few years is this interaction between theory and experiment ratcheting up, getting a bit tighter. This is beginning to happen. There's a whole program of experiments which are pitting different theories of consciousness against each other in so-called adversarial collaborations. That's really exciting. That's putting pressure on theorists to sharpen up their theories, to make them more testable, more distinguishable from other theories. And then we have, of course, these wonderful new technologies like optogenetics and other ways of manipulating causally conscious experiences that can give us greater insight.
Yeah. In the coming years and decades, I think the study of consciousness is only going to get more and more important. And hopefully some of the intractable scientific and indeed philosophical problems may become tractable. It's been a fascinating conversation. Personally, I could carry on talking to you about this all day, but I think we must wrap up. Thank you very much indeed for joining the London Futurist podcast.
Thanks, Callum. Thank you, David. It's been a real pleasure.